You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 315 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be talking to one of the minds behind Eden, Sven Hansen-Love, about his new film looking to tell the story of French house music, the scene that birthed the careers of a certain Daft Punk.
We'll also be meeting a Nobel Prize winner who'll be telling us how to match markets in business, education, and even how best to find a good owner for a new kidney. Economist Alvin Roth will be with us later.
And we'll also be talking to Salvador López López, director of dance troupe Ballet Folclórico de México, about why the company is back in London for the first time in 20 years.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's handsomest newshound Daniel Jacopelli will be revving up in the pink Current Affairs Cadillac for another news look ahead. And we'll enjoy some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom, hi.
Hi, Rob. A very good day to you.
It's nice to be on a Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it.
It's humid outside in London town. I don't know whether you in your neck of the woods and my neck of the woods, they're quite close together. I always like to commune at midday on a Sunday in nice air-conditioned Studio 2 today. Not Studio 1. The smaller one is cosy, but it's equally well-formed. And the aircon is right down at a freezing 13 degrees.
Exactly. It's cosy so, but cool at the same time.
Yeah.
And obviously, normally I just join...
I like your scarf, by the way.
And my long johns that I'm wearing. Normally I get to join you and Andrew Tuck briefly.
Yeah.
Just to be derided for a moment, mention a few news stories.
But that's right.
Today I'm in the hot seat.
You're in the hot seat.
For the whole hour.
And we've got Daniel Jacopelli, who we will introduce properly in a minute or two.
And we can deride and mock him.
We can deride him for turning up in his pink news Cadillac. Now let's talk. We talked in the introduction about Monocle's handsomest newshound.
Yeah,
Daniel
I didn't
Jacopelli.
Object to that during the top of the show, but I feel like...
Do you feel that needs to be addressed?
Well, I just, you know, maybe that's the prevailing view, in which case I'll... just be depressed and
I have a feeling
my...
that he probably broke into the Google Doc that we call our script and hijacked it and wrote into it himself.
It's the kind of thing he'd do.
But there he is. I expect he'll turn up in a sort of tight fitting t-shirt, like an extra from West Side Story.
100%.
But we don't know that yet, so let's welcome Daniel Jacopelli into the studio.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover.
Here he is, packed tightly into a short-sleeved shirt, like a GI.
Not very tightly.
It's like a GI on shore leave.
Well,
oversexed, overpaid.
Or something from...
And over here, Danny Jacopelli, welcome to the programme.
Good to be here,
Rob. One of the T-Birds.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
yeah, you're
dear.
A jet or a shark, Jen.
Well, it's because the song got you in that mood.
Yeah. I'm feeling very doo-wop. I'm feeling very 50s. I'm feeling like, really, I should be sipping something with a parasol in it.
I should go back to L.A. I was in L.A.
I always feel like that when I see Danny.
Yeah.
But, Danny, you're here to enlighten us and illuminate us on next week's news today.
Indeed. Shall we start?
Yes,
shall we go from serious to non-serious, as we normally
generally
do?
That's a better way around.
That's a better way around it. Despite
from
the fact
bad
we've
to good.
We've sort of talked about you looking like a sort of tin of sardines and things. Let's try.
Today, how's this for serious? North Korea's holding local elections today.
Wow.
What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Provincial, municipal, city, county, and district assemblies will be chosen. Maybe I'm just completely ignorant. I didn't know they actually had even the facade of democracy there. I thought it was kind of just...
Well, yeah, what are the options on the ballot paper?
Yeah.
Probably not many.
Just one.
This choice or death. Is that
yeah.
Is that okay to
Can
say
we
that?
Be making fun of that? I don't know. We probably shouldn't be making
it's
fun
not
of it.
It's
not funny at all.
I'm reminded of the Dunny in the World edition of Blackadder the Second. Tom Edwards will be familiar with
classic.
This. Yeah, it's a bit like that. I presume it's one of those where the only sitting... the only sitting parliamentarian is a dachshund called Colin. But anyway,
the most rotten of rotten boroughs.
What is a rubber? What is a rubber button? Anyway,
tomorrow. Speaking of smooth transition.
Speaking of dachshunds called Colin,
tomorrow is officially when the U.S. and Cuba restored diplomatic relations after that historic deal recently.
Right, after a hiatus.
Yeah, so they're going to reopen their embassies and all that jazz. So that's...
Where do you guys stand on this? Because a lot of people are saying, look, this is obviously something to welcome in so many respects, but actually Cuba will change in a sort of inescapable way, and it may not change solely for the better.
No, it won't.
No, not at all. Well, I mean, some things will be better, some things won't be.
You need to go
be.
To Cuba right now to sample this.
I think that's what a lot of people... I expect the flights to Havana are really busy ones at the moment from places in the world that might appreciate it, like Londoners, for example, that might appreciate it as it has been for the last sort of 30, 40 years.
But also, you have to be careful not to kind of fall into that parochial kind of colonial trap where you're saying, you know, we must see, you know, Cuba as it is now, because it is a very poor... and sometimes horrible place. I mean, there's lots of things great about it.
I was just saying before that, you know, your countrymen tendency, make everything into a golf course.
Of course.
It might be
but
worth
the tendency to
over.
Say, let's see the classic cars before they disappear. I mean, you know, they probably want new cars. I mean, it's not like they want to live in this, you know, museum city and country for the rest
of
their
life. It's your kind of cars, isn't it? 50s vibe.
Yeah.
T-Birds.
Yeah, black, white wall tires.
I think some things will change for the better and some things will change for the worse. Just like Iran right now, when it's opening up. I mean, I did a whole special
on
the entrepreneurs. I mean, you know, when Iran opens up, all of the local businesses will now have American competitors, you know, software giants coming in and, you know, Google, for instance, they'll have their... I mean, right now people could access things like AdWords and Gmail through roundabout ways. But once they really go in properly, it will hurt some local startups too, even though it'll open up, you know, a lot of opportunities. Cuba is a very different story than Iran.
It poses a very interesting question about how orientalist you should be about places like that, because you want them to open up enough for you to be able to go
exactly
and be able to drink about at least, you know, a proportion of the tap water, for example. No, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
it's not about the tourists.
You don't want everyone to be, you don't, you know, as nice as Google looks in a Persian script, you kind of want to be able to go to the local supermarket, see the local brands. You don't want it to change too
the
much.
The McDonaldization of everywhere is not good. I mean, you don't want Cuba to be, you know, another little outpost of Americans, you know, shopping on the high street.
Precisely.
You want it to be Cuban.
You're listening to LBC. Up next.
Let them
where
decide
next,
how they...
Where next? What have you got for us?
The Pan American Games in Toronto on the 20th also.
But doesn't just nobody care about this?
Well,
is that unfair?
7,600 of the top athletes in the Americas will be there.
What are the Pan American Games? Are they like the Olympics for the Americas?
Yeah.
So that was okay.
Well, I mean, I mean,
It's track and field and stuff like that?
Oh, all sorts, yeah.
Okay.
You have no idea, do you, Tom?
Yeah.
Is it wrestling? Do they have wrestling there?
Don't look at me.
It's a regional...
mean to make eye contact with you.
It's a regional sport.
You looked at me right when you said wrestling.
As wrestling.
It's quite broad brush, but I sense that it doesn't necessarily get the global interests flowing.
Well, we're not covering it, are we?
In Monocle magazine on the Francophone Games. Which is sort of so specifically niche that it is actually quite good. And there is such a thing as the Lusophone games.
Yeah,
as if you can only sort of punch a man in the face with boxing gloves on over 12 rounds using the Queensbury rules if you speak the same language as him.
It's brilliant.
It's strange, isn't it?
So you can apologise afterwards.
Yeah. Disculpe.
The 22nd, big news. My birthday.
Okay.
Danny, that's not big international news. We've talked about this before.
Okay. How about this? The 23rd...
There it goes. Is that Danny's new Chevy starting up?
It's the news
caddy.
What on earth was that?
That's your pink Cadillac of news firing up, ready to take you out of Studio
One. Is that like the...
regular listeners and they alone.
Is that the hook?
What that is?
The proverbial hook that takes me out when I do a bad job?
Yeah, it's idling outside.
Yeah, there it is.
In the same way that you do. So that means you've only got one more story.
Ernest Hemingway lookalike contest in Florida on the 23rd. Brilliant. How about that?
That sounds great. Does that happen in Key West?
Indeed, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's nice. Nice.
We're also going to be Sloppy Joe's. People are going to go there. 35th annual one.
A lot of linen suits.
Many a rum will be drunk.
Indeed. And how about one more?
Okay.
On the 23rd, the Great Texas Mosquito Festival takes place.
What is that?
Mosquito or mosquito?
Mosquito.
Mosquito.
As in
why do you have this like weird Spanish flair when you're saying it?
I think he thinks it's a cocktail.
Mosquito.
Again.
Well, no, I wonder.
What is that?
I wonder if it's a food and drink feature or something about insect life.
We're getting carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah, we are. What's that then?
I have no idea. It just sounded great.
They
have the world's largest mosquito, Willie, a 26-foot Texas mosquito. Has cowboy hat, boots, and blown up wings.
Oh, it's not an actual one.
No, it's a festival, and they have a large mosquito that. I'm really getting choked up here. I can't breathe anymore.
Danny, but climb on board your pink Cadillac of news and get the hell out of Dodge.
See you later.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokiosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらはモノクル24です。
Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
Là-haut. Passer une lettre.
Qu'est-ce qui vous plaît dans cette musique?
Le côté robot de la musique électronique avec la chaleur qu'apporte la soul.
On sent les DJ en devenir là.
Alors c'est vous le petit duo de garage dont tout le monde parle?
C'est qui ce mec?
Thomas Eggman.
Sors des sons, t'as jamais entendu ça.
Thomas.
Thomas et Daft Punk.
Eden is a new film telling the story of a Parisian DJ who watches the dance music scene that he helped grow in the early 90s with a group of friends develop into a world-engulfing music phenomenon.
The film, directed by Mia Hansen-Love and co-written by her brother DJ Sven Hansen-Love, has got rave reviews, if you'll excuse the pun, and two of its biggest fans, the dance music duo Daft Punk, who licensed their music to the film for a nominal fee, encouraging other acts to do the same. It helped the film get made, but Eden is also such a rich portrait of a scene because the people who made it lived it. The film's title character, Paul, is loosely based on Sven himself, and Sven himself is here in the studio with us. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Sven. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks to you.
Films about music are tough to do, aren't they? Unless you were there and you can kind of be part of the filmmaking process.
Yeah.
How did you capture the moment on film?
Well, the thing is, to begin with, like, it was my sister's idea to do that film, and she started by interviewing me for hours, and it was just some talking, and she took like notes, so it was really easy in the beginning. And the bad work, the big work, came after.
Right.
We had to structure it and write the scenes and the dialogues. And we had a lot of documentation because we knew many people from that scene. I was part of it. And we had all those people that we could see and ask them about it. So that really helped.
Now, people who watch the movie will see that it's a pretty kind of no holds barred picture of the journey that the main character goes on. How much autobiographical stuff was there in there for you? I'm sure people ask you this because you look very well, and yet he goes on quite a tough journey. You know, there's a lot of highs and lows and excesses. Was it a story of excess during that period for you and for other people involved around that scene? Was it always about pushing everything to the limit?
Yes, sort of, yes. I say very often, and it's a sort of love story. When you get in love with someone and you go completely crazy, and that's what happened to that character, and that's what happened to me. But I fell in love with the music. And also that's why you had a hard time to have relationships with girls, because they had to share me with the biggest kind of relation.
Love of your life, yeah.
And it's about excess, but it's also about the way when you're so much into something, you don't see the time that goes by, and you don't react quickly to see that.
We talked about the idea of, you know, films being it's tough to capture music on film and a scene and all the rest of it. How would you sum up that scene then? Because it's kind of, there've been a lot of sceney music movies, but this is kind of something that still seems quite underground. People know the kind of major acts. They know the Daft Punks of this world and all the rest of it. But what was the seed of it for you? Like where did it start? What sort of clubs were you playing? What sort of, how big were the crowds that you were playing to?
Well, I would mention the Queen Club,
which
it was really, really big in the 90s. And in those days we were all mixed up, like all the music was mixed up. You could hear like some techno and some French Touch, early French Touch, like the Daft Punk, but not only the Daft Punk, Cassius and things like that, but also the one, the music that I preferred, like which was Garage and Deep House. And we were all playing together. And the Queen was a club that it was, the entrance was free. And so everybody was going there. And it was quite big. And also like Coupole when I did my own party. But even if you have the feeling it was big, but it still was a small crowd, you know. If you compare us to what now, I mean, with all those big festivals, even in Paris, it's the crowd is much bigger right now.
And I wanted to ask you about the idea of the scene. And I guess the idea of a scene only exists after it's happened. You know, when you're actually just doing that and you're making music, there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas. People aren't snobbish about the labels that people give to people. People just play a certain type of music. Was that true back then?
It was exactly like that. And I can say it was already a scene, you know,
but yeah.
Just not so many people, but everyone was snobby with everyone.
Were they?
Okay. So it's probably the moment when you can say, it's a scene, right?
When you get tribes associated with it, with when people wear a certain type of clothing or they do this or they come out at that certain time because that's when that section of the night hots up in that particular club. They come from a particular DJ or whatever.
Right.
You know, I suppose. Yeah. And, so it's judgment all over.
Really. And me playing garage music, like, of course, garage like was more for gays and things like that. So, and me and my partner playing garage music, we were considered as cheesy or something.
Right.
But some people say we're in fact more snobby than the other ones.
Okay. So there's a refinement to even that.
It's pretty fucked up anyway.
Tell me about when you're sort of writing the movie then, because what's quite striking, certainly, you know, particularly in some of the early scenes in the film, you see that the music is really front and center. It's allowed to just speak for itself in a way that some other music or scene movies, call them what you will, doesn't let it do. They're too much. It's all about the characters and their journey. The music is really front and center constantly, and that's actually quite striking in the film. Was that something that was very important to you, to allow it to have that stage, that platform, to sort of speak for itself?
Yes, my sister really wanted the music to be almost like a character on the film, and as we started to work on it and especially editing, realized all important was the way we're gonna edit and introduce the music, the way that the music arrives in every scene, and especially in the club scene, obviously. But we had to think of the way the music sounds like. And one of the biggest, hardest part of the film was to work on the sound editing. Mm. And it's one of the parts I like the most as an experience myself. And every club scene is different. We mix the music in a different way on every club scene, and the difficult part was trying to be realistic, like authentic, but without feeling losing the emotion, the feelings, and that was difficult.
Ouais, partez sans moi, je le sens pas.
Je t'ai demandé de venir, c'est parce que j'ai besoin de toi. Parce que quand t'es pas là, je suis triste.
And how do you set up a party scene for a movie like that? I mean, you know, people know who you are because we're talking about the DJing, Sven, but you're a co-writer on this. Do you have to just workshop people? Do you have to just let people go wild on set and film it? Or because I always wonder, this isn't like pretending to drink a glass of wine in a play, and it's
tricky.
Lemonade. You know, how does it work on set?
Well, the first thing that was very important is to have to do a good work on the extras.
Yeah.
For the shooting. So
casting them really well and making sure they can have fun.
And it was a big part also because my sister insisted that we cast every extras, which normally you don't do. So it was an expensive thing to do. Right. So we had like 1,500 extras or something.
You're telling me a casting couch is not a fun thing to take part in.
The people who work on that, they send flyers everywhere, and that because we try to have like real young people. And then, yes, we ask them to dance, but you can't drink on the film, you know that, right? It's okay. Completely forbidden. So no okay. Alcohol okay. At all.
I think I get what you're saying.
So they had to get into it under their own power.
Yeah, well, the first shots are really bad, but the good thing is they get so tired after a while, and that's when it becomes good, you know, because they...
You see some real fatigue on their faces, yeah, you see the party. And as we say, co-writer on this film, but I mean, obviously a lot of it is your own experience, a lot of it comes from your experience of that whole scene. How much can you write a movie like this, and how much do you let your lead actors and actresses just play it out? I wonder how written it was.
My sister, she
I'm not trying to take your credit away.
My sister, she really likes to have like very precise scenes and dialogues, and so it was really written, I think. So it's not my choice. I mean, I'm not a screenwriter, really. Mm-hmm. But her foray was very important, and she had like sort of problems with one of the comedian, Vincent McCain, because he's a very funny guy, but he always like improvised, and she didn't want to, but so it was complicated to deal with.
Bit of a bashing of heads.
Yeah,
a little bit.
But it went well. But you know, she likes to be very. And on every shot, he was saying something different. So it was making her crazy.
There's a scene in the film where the character Paul, your sort of alter ego, gets his sister, I think, to play on the piano some notes so that he can, which is quite charming. And I wonder, is that a sort of a metaphor for your relationship with your sister? She's the sort of the studied one, the calm sense that maybe she's is she a little more disciplined, perhaps, and you're a bit of a looser character, maybe?
Perhaps. I didn't realize that, but probably, but it was completely that particular scene was just real, you know. I asked her to play those chords, and really those chords, the chords from that song, which is Sweet Harmony from Liquid. And I love those chords, and which is there, it's typical how Deep House chords. They come from another song, from Someday, from Cece Rogers. And yeah, I asked her to play them, and she did it. And she remembered. I didn't even remember that. I remember and nothing, you know. So anyway, I mean, she was there, so she told me you should remember. So.
And what about the reaction? You mentioned casting a lot of these young kids to play the extras. Did they really get into the music? Or is that too sort of a romantic an idea that they'd be like, wow, this must have been a crazy time?
Well, yeah, I mean... They didn't know really the music, many of them, and we sent them the songs before, because we know for some scenes, okay, we're gonna have two songs, like the very big scene in the club, it's Finally and another song, and we sent them before the shooting the songs, and we asked them to learn the lyrics, and no one did really. they just sing whatever, but what we did after. When we did the editing, we took again like 30 people and went in an audio room and asked them to sing, and then more precisely. And then we mixed the one that they did when the shooting, which was not precise at all, which was really bad, and they sang the song out of tune, but with better, and then we had something.
And is the movie, watching it back, is it an easy watch for you? Do you kind of have a flashback about it, or do you go, oh, this was great, I remember why I did it all?
No, never, because I was so much into it, like working on every aspect as a also artistic consultant and on everything. So I had no distance.
Yeah.
I never see the film, actually. I never saw the film because I was just working all the time on it, you know. I never had, it's not like I went in movie theater, oh my God, it's my life.
I'm on.
No, that never happens to me because I just, you know. Was so much into it anyway.
And do you think, I mean, there's a tendency when you look back, particularly if it's to create another creative project, a book or a film or something like this, to look back through rose-tinted spectacles and say, wow, you know, this was an amazing time. It was definitely better then. Do you think, is that a trap you try not to fall into? Do you think that there's probably, you know, another scene somewhere else that today is just as exciting and just as potentially thrilling? Or do you think there was something unique, something incredible about that scene coming out of Paris at that time?
No, I of course we try to evolve like nostalgia. My sister had a bit of nostalgia because she was very young, and she was like, I was her big brother, you know, things change, huh? But then, and she wanted to go back, and she was more serious, as you said. So she didn't party as much as me, but she wanted to try to go back in those days with the film. But I don't think we are saying it's the best time of real. No, we're just saying that we were young and the music was fresh. That's true. I mean, the music was fresh because it came out of from nowhere. And for us, it was a small revolution. But that happens all the time. Maybe not much anymore, but anyway.
Well, it's fantastic stuff. The film is called Eden. The co-writer of it is Sven Hansen Love. His sister Mia directed it. Decide for yourselves, I suppose, which serpent, which is the serpent, which is the apple, who's Adam and who's Eve, etc. Sven, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks to you.
We've just been talking about French dance music, so now let's have a slice of it. This is Generation, a new project from French dance producer Serkin, who was called in MIA to add some vocals to the new International Sound Part 2.
Generation and MIA with the new International Sound Part 2. I want to hear Part 1 after listening to that.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk economist. Economics, rather. That's coming up next.
We've got nothing less but a Nobel Prize winner on his way.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 on our robust new, upgraded, and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back with wise words from The Big Interview, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Professor Alvin Roth is an economist who knows more than most that everything has its price. But Alvin's work, centred on game theory, experimental economics and market design, tries to define that most uncategorisable commodity of all, human intuition and the simple matter of choice. Markets are often defined by supply and demand. Need to shift your goods? You lower the price. But in economics, as in life, some customers aren't that simple. And when choice between similar products, institutions, or even people themselves becomes a factor, that's where experts like Alvin start to think of how to best match markets to those seeking them.
Alvin's work has ranged from designing systems that more fairly allocate school places in the United States to life-saving models matching replacement kidneys to patients, 4,000 transplants that might never have taken place without him. And we only have to look at today's online world of almost infinite choices to understand that organising choices is a very powerful thing indeed. In 2012, Alvin shared the Nobel Prize for Economics for his pioneering work. He has a new book, Who Gets What and Why, and he's here now to give Rob and me a crash course of how to pick a winner. Alvin, perhaps we'll start with that idea that Rob actually mentioned there, this idea about intuition. A lot of these things are, they seem to be very subjective. They're about intuition, they're about instinct. Is it easy to bring an economist's discipline, which is all about, you know, absolutes, or we think it's all about absolutes, to bear on such a tricky subject?
Well, in a lot of markets, it's hard to figure out what you want. And the point of the marketplace is to help you figure that out, to make it easier to figure out. So it's not up to the economist to decide what you want, what job you want, what university you want to go to, what you need, what kind of medical treatment you need. But what the point of designing markets is to make it easy to get what you think you want.
Alvin, the book's a very readable one, and it's a subject that lots of people might go, whoa, might kind of wince at, because it's big and it's important, and it's scary, it's in all the news at the moment. But you write with a flair for analogy. But I always wonder whether an actual market where people have stalls of things selling things is anything like the markets that you're talking about, the financial markets, the sort of macro world of economics. Are markets like markets?
Well, there are lots of different kinds of markets, so that's part of what I talk about. I think often when we think of markets, we think of commodity markets, markets where you can deal anonymously with other parties and where only the price matters. When you buy shares of stock in a corporation, you don't care who you're buying them from. They don't care who they're selling them to. But when someone offers you a job, that's a very personal offer. And, you know, Google, say, doesn't hire its engineers by lowering the wage until just enough engineers want to come to work. It's a desirable job. It pays a high wage. And it's not a market, therefore, in which supply equals demand. And so there are all sorts of other market clearing mechanisms that to get a job. There are applications and interviews and hiring decisions. And the same can be said about college admissions, for example. I teach at Stanford University, and we don't decide on our entering class by raising tuition until just enough students would like to come. So it's not the tuition price at which supply equals demand. Instead, there are all these other processes of application and interviews and admissions. So labor markets, college admissions, things like that are a little bit like courtship and marriage. You can't just choose your spouse. You also have to be chosen. And that's what I mean when I speak about matching markets, or markets where you can't just choose what you want. Even if you can afford it, you also have to be chosen, like getting a job.
And Alvin, I wonder, you know, do you think that some of the problems we talk about, you know, the big markets and money markets or whatever, do you think there is a bit of a disconnect there, that people are interested in charting what happens, but maybe not that much in why it happens? Is there, I don't know if that's an impatience, is it a lack of almost intellectual curiosity between some of the people who are actually making decisions that are influencing what happens on the money markets, for example, but they're actually surprisingly lacking in curiosity about why the things that they observe and that their decisions depend on happen.
Well, you might drive a car without knowing how it works. And that's actually pretty convenient. If your car works pretty well, then you don't have to think about it. You step on the gas and it goes. But if you started to look at different kinds of cars, you'd see that there are all sorts of varieties. There are cars with electric motors now. There are cars with diesel motors. So if you were interested in cars, you'd find a lot to be interested in. And a little bit of book about markets is like a field guide to the birds or a field guide to flowers. It's meant to open your eyes to the variety of experiences that you go through and also help you navigate them better.
I like that something you wrote in there about markets are a bit like gossip, and that's one of the things that attracts you to markets and writing about them. Tell us, maybe you can take that idea for a little bit of a walk for us, Alvin, the idea of markets being like gossip. What's that mean?
Well, so they're like gossip in the sense that when you look at, say, labor markets, you discover how people get their jobs in different professions and the kind of difficult decisions they have to make and what kinds of decisions you might have had to make had you decided to go to law school instead of journalism school. And in many of those markets, some of those markets don't work so well, and they go through transitions in which the people who are involved in them have some difficult decisions. So, for example, among the markets I've studied in the U.S. and also in Britain are the markets for new doctors. And that's a difficult transition, going from medical school to becoming a doctor. Here it's a house officer. In the United States, it's called a resident. And that's quite a tough transition. And in different regions of the National Health Service, it's more or less difficult. And knowing how those markets work can help people navigate them because they have strategic choices to make, the kind of choices you make when you interact in a system made of rules in a market where what happens to you will depend also not only on what you're doing, but on what other people are doing as well. The same thing might be said of school choice, which is a big deal here in Britain as it is in the United States. In the United States, what we found, and I think this is true presently in Britain, we found that many of the systems of school choice in American cities didn't make it safe for families to tell the school district what schools they would like their children to go to. It didn't make it safe for them to tell, quite honestly, because in a lot of American cities, we've been able to modify this. It used to be that if you didn't get the choice of school that you said was your first choice, then you might do quite badly. You might find that your second choice school had already been filled with people who said it was their first choice, and your third choice school was filled as well. So rather, when they said to you, what's your first choice, rather than picking the school that you thought it would be great if your kid went to, even if there wasn't a big chance of that, you had to concentrate on thinking, what's the best school I can get if I say it's my first choice? And we thought that that was working badly in for many American cities. And so we've been able to redesign school choice in New York and in Boston and in New Orleans and in Denver so that if you don't get your first choice, your chance of getting your second choice will be just as great as if you had said it was your first choice. And that makes it safe to say what your first choice is and your second choice and your third choice, which is important because it's hard to give people what they want if it's not safe for them to tell you what they want.
Yeah, right. I like that one. I wanted to ask you a question which might well have been in our introduction to you, Alvin, which is about the Nobel Prize, which you won. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What is that like? Does that colour everything you do afterwards? I mean, does that make this book a little bit more of a pressureful thing to have to fulfil? Is it an albatross?
So I hope not. You know, I only got
it. Is it any sort of bird?
Well, so it's something that makes me a little cautious about speaking outside things that I know well. So today, things happened involving Greek debt. It would be natural getting on the radio to answer questions about that. I have opinions about it, but I'm not an expert. It's not something I'm an expert on. And one thing that having a Nobel Prize makes me cautious about is if I speak about Greece, the headlines will say, Nobel Prize winner says this about Greece. And I'm not an expert on Greece. If we're having a beer, I have opinions. I could tell you them. But but I wouldn't want them to be published as if I had studied the economy.
So it's an interesting thing. So it does. It sort of focuses your interest and makes it a professional level of interest. It's an interesting thing, actually, that you have to be careful what you sort of say it's within your remit. You know,
I think I have to be careful of what I say to journalists, what I have to say in public, yes.
Alvin,
Tom and I do very good impersonations of people that aren't at all journalists.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you a little bit more. We mentioned in the introduction both the school place allocation, which you've been talking about, and also this idea about matching, you know, kidneys to kidney patients. And I wonder, to sort of pick up on what Rob was saying about how your life changes maybe after winning an award like that, do you find that it reshaped how easy, or do you imagine it might make it easier to make changes, to advise people on things that have very profound consequences? You're talking about, you know, thousands of transplants that might not otherwise take place. Do you think it might make people more receptive to your ideas, to your thinking, to your recommendations, if you've got that kind of, I don't know, it's a bit of a fillip, that sort of kudos behind you? Does it make a difference, or might it go on to make a difference?
I think it might. And part of my reason for writing this book is not merely to be a field guide to markets and let people know how to see the markets that they're involved in and how to engage in them, but also to let people know that economists are now market designers as well, and that therefore it shouldn't be surprising to you that if you're dealing with a marketplace that's having difficulties, that maybe it would be helpful to talk to an economist. That was not obvious. As you say, when my colleagues and I started to talk to kidney surgeons, they didn't automatically greet us as fellow members of the helping professions. You know, they didn't quite understand how economists thought they might be able to help organize the kidney exchanges that have now become a standard part of transplant in the United States and are growing in Britain as well.
And I wonder, it's interesting you make that point about being a market designer. Do you think there's been a shift to being more active as an economist, away from maybe something that was a little more, if not passive before, a little less engaged in that way? Do you think that's something quite, is that a profound change maybe for people who are in your discipline?
It is. And I think that's what my Nobel Prize was about. So let me say that market design is something new for economics, for economists, but it's an ancient human activity. Markets are older than agriculture. They're the kinds of things that people do, like language. But like agriculture, how we do it has changed over time. Again, I'm speaking beyond my expertise, but I think the earliest agriculturalists probably just cultivated the plants that they found. And today, the plants we eat are cultivars. They've been modified over time. And so I think in the same way, economists used to study the markets that we found. And now we're starting to be able to modify them a little bit. And a similar transition probably happened to medicine. There was a time when what doctors could do for you is tell you what was going to happen to you. But now we expect doctors to be able to intervene and maybe alter what's going to happen to us and help us out. And so when markets are in trouble, economists are starting to be able to alter what might happen to them and help them out.
I wanted to ask you a quick question about your teaching at Stanford and about your students there, whether the types of questions or whether the motivation for studying what you teach has changed a little bit over the years. Because you talk about some of the new tech companies in your book, Airbnb and people like this. And I wonder whether that streamlining, that sort of like taking the middleman out, or that kind of streamlining of some of these markets online, it motivates people to study economics, whether people are going into it not as something to study, but as something that can have very practical outcomes for them professionally.
Well, I think so. I think in Silicon Valley, we have a lot of market makers.
Yeah.
And a lot of these biggest firms, these fast-growing firms that we're seeing, are firms that make markets. You know, Google is a market for advertisements. Amazon and eBay are markets for things that you can buy. Airbnb and Uber are markets to match travelers with rooms or with cars. LinkedIn is a market for jobs.
Let's talk about Tinder.
Yeah, Tinder is a market for dates, for courtship. And of course, marriage markets have changed over time. I in the United States, the average age of marriage has gone up in the last 100 years. I imagine it has in Britain, too. What seems to cause this is the growing participation of men and women in higher education and the growing participation of women in the labor force. So where once it might have been wise to marry your sweetheart, you know, before you went off to university, now there'll still be a thick marriage market in university. There are lots of unattached men and women there. And when you go into the labor force, sometimes those markets get thinner. And so internet dating markets start to come into their own because one of the jobs that a marketplace has to do is make the market thick, bring lots of people together.
I love the idea of a thick market. It's very sort of, it sounds very verdant, doesn't it? It sounds fecund, to use a D.H. Lawrence word. Well, it's fantastic. You're so wonderful at talking about the book. There's lots of big themes in it. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. Alvin Roth is the author of Who Gets What and Why. Thank you very much, Alvin, for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Who said print was dead? certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brûlé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brûlé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry
Mexico
review
is a country
and
whose image
show.
Travels well
every Saturday
abroad.
At
food,
10 a.m.
Music,
London
culture.
Time.
But the nation
Make
itself
a part
is a complex
listen
lineup built upon thousands
on iTunes
of years
or
of societies, and then of course the Spanish way of life that imprinted itself on Mexico during its colonization. In 1952, dancer Amalia Hernandez started a Ballet Folclórico de Mexico, a dance company set up to show the diversity of Mexico and put its indigenous cultures on the map, as well as the later Spanish influence, which we all know it for.
The company is performing at the English National Opera at London Coliseum Theatre next week, the first time it's been to London for 20 years. And I'm delighted to say we're joined now by the company's director and Amalia's grandson, Salvador López López, to learn how to convey a country through dance and why the family business is back in town. Salvador, great to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about that feeling when you are travelling with the company. Do you feel a little bit like, I don't know, ambassadors almost of Mexico? Or is it just a professional engagement? How do you feel about
no,
it?
No, I think we are bringing the soul of Mexico to the different cultures around the world. I've been traveling with the company since I was maybe 4 years old with my grandmother around the world. So it's been quite a strong experience. In the early 70s and 80s, Mexico was known because of the Ballet Folklórico de Mexico. There was no communication at all, like internet or things that are happening today. But the company was a cultural ambassador and, of course, a tourist promoter of the... I have to repeat what the prime minister of China said, is the best face of Mexico.
Well, it sounds like a great thing. The idea of the Ballet de Folklórico... Is there an indigenous ballet? Is it ballet as we would understand it in the West, or Spanish Mexico would understand it, or is it sort of adapting folk dance and folk tradition and folk music into the idea of Western ballet? What are the kind of where do the two worlds meet?
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's both of us. What did you say? It's let's say Amalia's talent, in my point of view, was that he extract the very deepness way of dancing in small towns, the music, the colors, the spirit of dancing, and create a performance that shows what we feel about dancing, what we feel about our culture. And as always said, the Mexican culture captures once and never let you go. So it's like Amalia's put on stage the essence of our culture in 2 hours.
So yeah. it's a roller coaster then.
Yeah,
okay. And is this the kind of thing that in the notes the program notes, for example, do you have to be quite didactic? Do you have to tell people what this is all about? Do you have to explain it a bit to people? Or do you want people just to sit back and be enthralled and wowed by something that's probably very new for most people?
The magic of the Ballet Folklórico is that you don't have to read anything. You have to see the performance and then you will be interesting on... learning what's come from, why is happening this, but the diversity of the program and the way they take you to one place to another, and then I hope at the end of the program you start dancing on the streets like Mexican.
That's what I want to see as well. What we need a camera inside, camera outside.
Exactly.
Whether it's exportable.
Yeah.
I don't know how full of joie de vivre the London audience is, though. Sometimes they're a bit of a bit of hard work to get them dancing in the streets.
They're good at clapping, not so good at dancing.
But I was going to say, what's the reaction like as you go around the world? Though, are you always very struck by how different the response is in different places? Are some people literally dancing in the aisles, and other people a bit more reserved? How different is it?
Well, of course. I mean, for us coming to London is one of the most important cities for spectacles, and you have everything here, like New York, maybe Paris, not too many cities like those ones. But the response depends very much on, let's say, if it's popular music. When we perform in Mexico City, around Mexico City, I mean, it's like a whole party because they understand very well what we're doing. When they come here, there's some critics, but I have to repeat this. The magic of the company captures you, and then you enjoy the performance. Maybe you don't understand some things, but you're very deep into the performance. That's why the company has been around for 64 years. So I think keep a company running for 64 years is difficult, but keep it running with success is almost impossible. So what Somalia did since the very beginning, and we're doing the hard work, keeping the company on the same level.
And I wonder how sponge-like Ballet Folklórico de México is. I wonder whether you can pick up influences over the last 60 years, the lifespan of the company at the moment, whether it's picked up tricks of the trade where it's pitched its tent, you know, where it's performed, or whether you have to be quite strict about what is Mexican folkloric ballet and how modern it can be and how old fashioned it has to be.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a real, whether it's kind of like a gold standard or whether it picks up influence.
Well, what I'm doing. I'm have to bring the company to the new things, to the new way of seeing shows. The company is much more prepared, the dancers, than they were on the 60s or 70s. Mm. And then we use technology like lights and new sound systems, new sound arrangements. So the company, we have on the New York Times, we have a review from last year that says that the company, the age only makes the company younger. So this is what the way I see the company.
Yeah.
So the years makes the company younger, looks younger. So that's what I see the company.
And what do we see on stage then when we actually go to the show in terms of the number of performers, the sort of range of the performance? What sorts of things are in the show that people will see?
Okay, well, we come. It's not a let's say there's I mean the 40 dancers and live music almost all of the show. But I mean, what we can see is when you go on stage and you see the indigenous dances and then the more post-Columbian dancers and the influence from Afro-Latin rhythms and then the way the music from Veracruz as the Gulf Coast of Mexico with the harp and the percussion. So what you see, it's a variety that goes, that's non-stop from the very beginning to and we have a surprise at the end of the show. That is a surprise that I can tell you that, but you have to go and see it.
There's no spoiler alerts on this show. Just finally, Salvador, we haven't asked you about the themes of it, actually. I mean, European ballet is all about good and evil, and it's about princes and princesses, but it's about, they're kind of timeless themes, right? The storylines and things. Uh-huh. What about in your show? Is that where the folklore comes from, the storylines?
Okay. I named this show Así te envuelve México. That's the way Mexico abrazes you. That's the way Mexico abrazes you. Why I'm saying this? Because let's say it's even the dancers, you can see how they enjoy to dance the Mexican. But that's the way I can say it. This is the way Mexico abrazes you. There's a way we can share our history and our energy with the London audience.
So does it talk about, is quite a lot of this about Mexican history,
yeah,
different versions of Mexican history,
yeah,
and depending upon whose side maybe
yeah
you are?
Yeah.
Okay, nice.
I would like to be to feel the embrace of the Mexican ballet.
I'm going to go to this show, Tom, and I should be dancing in the street afterwards. Doesn't take me many margaritas.
You should.
Yeah. Rob might dance in the street on the way to get there. That's what sometimes happens.
It's all right. I am looking forward to seeing this. It sounds like an amazing thing. Salvador Lopez, thank you very much for talking us through the Ballet Folklorico de Mexico. And you've got to tell our listeners where and when the show is on.
Sure. It starts on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We'll have 5 performances. It's at the London Coliseum. And I'm not sure about the time of the performance, but I think they're at 8 o'clock, and we have 2 performances on Saturday.
It's going to be gorgeous. Salvador, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Ballet Folklorico de Mexico is at London's Coliseum Theatre for 5 dates from Wednesday the 22nd of July onwards. And that's all for edition 315 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom. I enjoyed today's programme.
Where would you rank it, Rob? Of all 315, have you? I mean, you've been involved
with almost
all of them.
I think it's in the three tens.
Solid!
No, I think it's top 20 show. I really liked
it. Top 20?
Yeah, it's pretty good, right? It's pretty good.
Yeah, that's lofty.
I particularly liked Folklorico Dancio Mexico Man.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know I sound a bit like a character from the Far Show there.
No.
Scottish.
And he was talking about dancing in the streets. One of your favourite music videos of all time.
One of my favourites. Exactly. I think. Should we look through the plate glass and see if Tom Hall's going to do an impersonation of David Bowie? There he is. For anyone that doesn't know, the Dancing in the Street music video featuring Mick Jagger and David Bowie, two titans of pop. Google it now. Get it on your YouTube channel. As we fade out, fade that up, and then that is the perfect Sunday afternoon wherever you are in the world, isn't it, Tom?
Well, it couldn't be more perfect.
Should we thank our friends behind the glass?
I suppose we have to.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
This show's back at the same time next week. I imagine it'll be Robert Bound and perhaps Andrew Tuck back
in
the hot seat.
I expect it's sort of back to the same old. You'll be the news hound.
I'll be news hounding. Don't bring that up.
Okay, all right. I'm terribly sorry. All right, for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.